This is Audible.
Blizzard Entertainment, Inc. presents I, Mengsk by Graham McNeil. Performed by Neil Kaplan. Beginnings. Valerian heard the knock at the door, but ignored it, concentrating instead on the tawny port that swirled in the expensive cut crystal glass held in one manicured hand. The knock came again, more insistent this time, and the tone and impatience of the sound told Valerian Mengsk who was on the other side of the door without his having to answer it. He smiled as he sipped his drink, the gesture out of place on his handsome features this day, or on any other day recently for that matter. Valerian settled into the deep leather upholstery of the chair, enjoying the heat of the room's coal fire and the warmth of the drink in his belly. Precious little else had given him enjoyment these last months, for they had been thankless and pain-filled. The pain had not been his, at least not physically. But it had been hard watching his mother suffer as the wasting sickness melted the flesh from her bones and unraveled her mind. Valerian stared into his glass of port, a fine blend with a rich, fulsome flavor that lingered long on the palate and was the perfect accompaniment to the wildfowl being served to the guests awaiting him in the main chamber of his home. His home. The words still felt unusual, the fit not yet settled upon him. Valerian looked up from his drink and cast his eyes around the room, taking in every exquisite detail. The fine mahogany paneling that concealed sophisticated communications arrays and elaborate countermeasures against electronic eavesdropping, the silken wall hangings, the gold-framed portraits, and the tasteful uplighters that bathed the high-ceilinged room in a warm, restful illumination. But pride of place on the walls was reserved for the many weapons of Valerian's collection that hung between the more archaic decorations. A long-bladed falx rested on silver hooks, curved swords hung by their quillons, and a multitude of punch daggers and bizarre circular weapons with blades protruding from leather hand grips were set on concealed hooks. Glass cases against the walls contained antique pistols of wood with gold inlay and long-barreled muskets with battery packs fitted to their skeleton stocks. A marble surround contained the crackling fire, and a grainy hollow plate sat upon the mantel. It shimmered with the ghostly image of a woman with wistful eyes, from which Valerian studiously kept his gaze averted. He stared into the fire and sipped his port as the door opened behind him. Only one person would dare enter the chambers of Valerian Mengsk without invitation.
"Hello, father," said Valerian.
A shadow fell across him, and Valerian looked up and saw his father's stern, patrician features staring down at him. Though he had seen the face of Arcturus Mengsk 1,000 times in holographic form, his father's sheer physical presence had a powerful charisma that no mere technology could capture. Arcturus was a big man, broad of shoulder and thick of waist, with hair that had once been dark and lustrous, but was now streaked with silver. His beard contained more white than black, and where age might weary other men, it had only enhanced the natural gravitas and dignity with which Arcturus had already been generously endowed. His father's black frock coat, similar to the one worn by his son, did nothing to disguise his bulk and only emphasized his power. Gold frogging edged the coat, and wide bronze epaulets framed his shoulders. A basket-hilted sword and magnificently tooled pistol hung from his belt. But Valerian knew it had been many years since his father had cause to draw either of these weapons in anger.
"I knocked," said Arcturus. "Didn't you hear me?"
"I heard you," said Valerian, nodding.
"And why didn't you answer the door?"
"I didn't think you'd need an invitation, father," replied Valerian. "You are the Emperor, aren't you? Since when does an Emperor wait on the pleasure of others?"
"I may be the Emperor, Valerian, but you are my son."
"I am that," agreed Valerian, "now that it suits you."
"You are angry," said Arcturus. "That's understandable, I suppose. It's only natural for people to behave irrationally over these kinds of things."
"These kinds of things?" snapped Valerian, rising from his chair and hurling his glass of port into the fire. "Show a bit of damned respect!" The glass shattered, and the fire roared as the alcohol burned ruby red in the flames.
"Have you no feelings for others?" cried Valerian. No sooner had the words left his mouth than he realized what he'd said and to whom he'd said it.
Valerian laughed.
"What am I saying? Of course you don't!"
Arcturus remained unmoved by Valerian's outburst and simply laced his hands behind his back.
"That was a waste of good port," he said. "And a nice glass, if I'm any judge. I thought I had taught you better than to show anger, especially when it serves no purpose."
Valerian took a deep breath and turned away from his father, making his way to a drinks cabinet set into the wall. His precious malts and ports were protected from the attentions of poisoners by reflective glass sheathed in an impenetrable energy field, the installation of which had been at the behest of his father, since anyone who knew anything of the Menx dynasty would know of their love for quality liquors. Valerian paused for a moment and studied his reflection as he reached for the recessed brass button that would disengage the security field. Valerian's blonde hair spilled around a face that was handsome to the point of beautiful. His features were unmistakably his father's, but where Arcturus wore his hard edges plainly, Valerian's were softened by the influence of his mother's genes. Full lips and wide, storm cloud eyes that could charm the birds from the trees sat within a face of porcelain smooth skin and noble features. At 21, he was a beautiful young man, and he knew it, though he was careful to keep that knowledge hidden beneath a veneer of modesty, which, of course, only served to heighten his appeal to the opposite sex. He pressed his thumb against the button, the gene reader on its surface, comparing his DNA with the hourly updated records held within the building's mainframe. Though the technologies of the modern world were commonplace to him, Valerian detested the idea of function overwhelming form. A slight ripple in the air was the only sign of the protective fields disengaging. Valerian opened the glass door to pour two fresh drinks, selecting another tawny port for himself and an expensive ruby vintage for his father. Valerian returned to the fire, where his father had taken one of the two chairs. His basket-hilted sword sat propped up against the armrest. Arcturus nodded appreciatively as Valerian handed him the glass.
"Calmer now," asked his father.
"Yes," said Valerian.
"Good. It does not become a Menx to openly display his thoughts."
"No?"
"No," said Arcturus. "When men think they know you, they cease to fear you."
"What if I do not want to be feared?" asked Valerian, sweeping his coattails beneath his rump and sitting opposite his father.
"You would rather be loved,"
countered Arcturus, sipping his port.
"Can't one be both?"
"No," said Arcturus. "And before you ask, it is always better to be feared than loved."
"Well, you'd know," replied Valerian.
Arcturus laughed, but there was no warmth to the sound.
I am your father, Valerian, and cheap jabs will not change that. I know you do not love me as a father ought to be loved, but I care little for that. However, if you are to succeed me, you will need to be tougher.
And if I do not want to succeed you?
Irrelevant, snapped Arcturus. You are a Mengsk. Who else is there?
Anger touched Valerian.
Even a Mengsk you called a bookish, effeminate weakling?
Arcturus waved a dismissive hand.
Words spoken in haste many years ago, he said. You have proved me wrong, so move on. Scoring points over me does you no credit.
Valerian covered his irritation at his father's stoicism by drinking some port, letting the aromatic liquid sit in his gullet a while before swallowing. He watched as Arcturus used the pause to look around the room at the weapons hanging from the walls. The one point of common ground upon which they could converse without the threat of argument or resentment rearing its ugly head.
You have made a fine home here, son, said Arcturus, apropos of nothing.
Home, said Valerian. I don't know what that word means.
Seeing the puzzlement in his father's eyes, Valerian continued.
Until a few months ago, home was simply where we settled until we had to move on, from one crumbling Eumogen moon to another, or one of the few orbitals the UED or the Zerg hadn't destroyed. You must know the feeling, surely?
I do, conceded Arcturus. Though I'd forgotten it, for a long time home was a Hyperion. But then with all that happened with Jim.
What about Core Hall 4? Said Valerian, not wishing to endure another tirade regarding the treachery of Jim Raynor.
Over the last few years, Valerian had thrilled to the adventures of Jim Raynor, and had secretly admired the man as the thorn in his father's side the former marshal had proved to be. Arcturus shook his head, quickly masking his irritation at the interruption.
Vast areas of the planet are habitable again, and we have rebuilt much of what was destroyed. But even I don't have the power to undo in so short a time the damage done by the Confederacy. Core Hall will be great again, I have no doubt, but it will never be what it once was.
I suppose not, agreed Valerian. I should have liked to see Core Hall before the attack.
Ah, yes. You would have liked it, I think, said Arcturus. The Palatine Forum, the Golden Library, the Marshall Field, the Somervilla. Yes, you would have liked it.
Valerian leaned forward.
I would like to learn of Core Hall, he said. From someone who is there, I mean, not dry facts from a digitome or holocene, but the real thing. From someone who walked its surface and breathed its air.
Arcturus smiled and nodded, as though he had expected such a request.
Very well, Valerian. I will tell you of Core Hall, what I know of it, and what I have pieced together over the years, but I'll tell you more than that, if you've the wit to hear it, said Arcturus, standing and draining the last of his port.
What do you mean? Asked Valerian.
The story of Core Hall is the story of your grandfather and what it means to be a Mengsk. Core Hall was the forge in which our dynasty was hammered into shape, raw and bloody, upon the anvil of history.
Valerian felt his heart quicken. Yes, that's what I want.
Arcturus nodded toward the woman in the holographic plate upon the mantelpiece.
And I'll tell you of your mother.
My mother? Said Valerian, instantly defensive.
Yes,
said Arcturus, making his way toward the door.
But first we have to bury her.
Book 1. Angus. 25 years earlier. Chapter 1. The villa was dark, its occupants asleep. From the outside it looked peaceful and quiet, vulnerable. He knew, of course, that it was not. Laser trips surrounded the villa in an interconnected web. Motion sensors swept the high marble wall that surrounded it, and tremor alarms were set into the floors and walls around every opening. It wasn't the most expensive security system money could buy, but it wasn't far off. To penetrate the Menksk summer villa, a white-walled compound perched on a headland of white cliffs overlooking the dark waters of the ocean, would be no easy feat, and the silent figure took his time as he approached the farthest edge of the system's detection envelope. The scanner attached to his belt, used by prospectors of the Confederate Exploration Corps, was a modified geosurvey unit, a harmonic detector set to read the electromagnetic returns of Vespine gas. It had been a simple matter to adjust the sensors to pick up the security lasers and link its display to the goggles he wore over his young, handsome face. For such a device to work, you had to know the frequency of the lasers and the exact mineral composition of the crystals that produced them, all of which had been simplicity itself to obtain from one of the techs who had installed the system only the previous summer. The goggles bleached everything of color. The midnight blue of the sky was rendered a flat rust color, the mountains to the north a deep bronze, and the sea a shimmering crimson, like an ocean of blood. The walls of the villa were dark to him, the lasers and sensor returns gleaming like cords of silver strung like a hunter's tripwires. "Too easy," he whispered, then inwardly chided himself for the unnecessary words. The figure dropped to his belly and slithered around the northern side of the villa, avoiding the road that ran all the way to Stirling and keeping to the tall grass that waved in the brisk winds blowing in off the sea. The net of lasers moved regularly, but pre-programmed algorithms in the survey unit meant that by the time they shifted, he was already in a patch of dead ground. Of course, no algorithm was completely perfect, and there was always a chance that he would be detected, but he was confident in his abilities and wasn't worried about failure. In truth, the prospect of failing was something that hadn't occurred to him. Failure was something that happened to other people, not to him. He was good at what he did and knew it. It gave him a confidence that reached out to others and made it all the easier to ensure he always got what he wanted. Well, almost always. He eased over closer to the villa, keeping his movements slow and unhurried. He knew that to rush things would be to invite disaster, and it took him nearly 2 hours to come within 6 meters of the wall. Passive infrared motion sensors were built into the eaves of the wall, but these were old systems, installed nearly a decade ago, and were about as sophisticated as those you'd find protecting some fringe world magistrate. It was most assuredly not what you'd expect to find protecting the summer villa of one of Korhal's most renowned senators and his family. The figure was rendered invisible to these sensors by the coolant systems of the black, form-fitting bodysuit he wore. He had fashioned it in secret from the inner lining of a hostile environment suit used by miners when prospecting high-temperature sites, and he smiled as he rose to his feet and the beam swept over him without detecting him. Once again the laser net shifted, and he froze as the new pattern was established. He let out a breath as he saw a glimmering, hair-thin beam of light at his calf, and carefully eased away from it. It would be another 17.3 seconds before they changed again, and he shimmied up to the wall, careful not to touch it for fear of setting off the tremors. He was within the laser net, and so long as he kept close to the wall but didn't touch it, he would be invisible to the villa's security. Taking a moment to compose himself, the figure eased around the compound, heading for the delivery entrances. He froze as a patch of light was thrown out onto the ground. A door opening. A man came out followed by another, and he felt a flutter of fear. Then they sparked up cigarettes and began to smoke and gossip. He let out a breath, his heart hammering against his ribs. Kitchen porters, nothing more. They moved away from the door, taking refuge from the cold wind behind a lean-to, and he took this golden opportunity to sneak forward and slip through the door, flipping up the lenses of his goggles as he entered the kitchen. Warmth assailed him from the large stone-built ovens, and the air was redolent of the lingering aroma of the Mengsk family's last meal. This time of night, the kitchen was empty. The cooks and skivvies retired for the night before rising early to prepare breakfast, and he briefly wondered what the two smokers were doing up this late. He dismissed the matter as irrelevant and continued onward, moving from the kitchen to the door that led toward the main entrance hall, easing it open and looking out into the shadowed chamber. Portraits of Angus Menx's illustrious ancestors lined the walls, and a number of tasteful statuettes, vases, and weapons chosen by his wife Catherine were displayed on fluted columns. In contrast to the dignity of these objets d'art, a number of toys belonging to Angus's youngest child, Dorothy, were scattered at the bottom of a flight of carpeted stairs that led up to the family bedrooms. The tiled floor was a black-and-white checkerboard pattern, and he waited as a guard entered from across the hall and checked in with his compatriots in the security room on a throat mic. Angus Mengsk kept only a handful of armed guards within the summer villa, claiming that he came here to get away from the trouble Korhal was having with the Confederacy, not to be reminded of it. The guard turned from the front door and started toward the dining room, shutting the door behind him. With the guard gone, the figure swiftly entered the hall and made his way up the stairs, pausing at the top to glance along the wide corridor. The bedroom shared by Angus and Catherine was to his left, but the figure set off in the opposite direction, toward the bedrooms of the Mengsk family children. The floor was wooden, covered with thick rugs, and he walked carefully on it, avoiding the places in the floor where he knew the wood creaked. He stopped before a thick door with a bronze A fixed to the wood and smiled to himself. He gripped the handle, softly opened the door, and ghosted inside the room. The room was dark, with long benches strewn with dismantled equipment and rock samples lining the walls. Framed images of geological strata and rock compositions hung from the walls, and a lumpen, sheet-covered form rested in the large, iron-framed bed. He took a step into the room, and a voice said, "I suppose you think that was clever." Turning around, he saw Achtenfeld, head of security for the Mengsk family, seated on a plush leather chair in the far corner of the room. Dressed in a dark uniform jacket and loose-fitting trousers, Feld's hand rested on the butt of a heavy pistol. He was tall and powerful, built exactly as one would imagine a head of security would be proportioned. The figure in black relaxed and removed the goggles, revealing patrician features, a strong jawline, and the wide, eager gray eyes of a 17-year-old boy. "I thought it was very clever of me, as a matter of fact," said Arcturus Mengsk. Achtenfeld examined the geosurvey unit with a critical and not unimpressed gaze. The boy had managed to put together quite an infiltration package, and Feld was going to have to thoroughly review the security procedures in place at the summer villa. He put the geosurvey unit down. If Arcturus could get this far, there was no telling how far someone with more malicious intent might reach. Fell didn't want to think about the consequences of that. Korhal was in a volatile enough state as it was without something happening to Angus Mengsk. To have so outspoken an opponent of the Confederacy murdered in his bed would be a blow from which the fledgling independence movement on Korhal might never recover. "Shouldn't you be at the academy in Stirling?" "I got bored, said Arcturus, sitting on the edge of the bed and pulling the covers back to reveal a series of pillows arranged to give the semblance of a human being.
They weren't teaching me anything I didn't already know.
That was probably true, reflected Feld. Arcturus Mengsk was many things, including a truculent teenager and a selfish rogue who possessed a confidence some called arrogance. But he was also fiercely clever and excelled at everything to which he turned his hand.
Your father won't be happy about this.
When is he ever happy with what I do? Countered Arcturus.
Once a rebel, always a rebel, eh?
Said Feld.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing, forget it, replied Feld. So why break into your own house?
Arcturus shrugged.
To see if it could be done, I suppose.
And that's all?
Well, maybe to annoy my father.
Arcturus smiled.
That never gets old.
Oh, I have no doubt it'll annoy him, said Feld. Especially now. And after he's gotten through chewing me out, I'm sure he'll have some choice words for you, too.
So, how did you do it?
Asked Arcturus.
Find me, I mean, the bodysuit kept me off the infrared, and I know the laser net didn't get me. So, how did you know?
And why should I tell you? If anything, I should be hauling you over the coals to find out how you got this far. You had help, didn't you?
No,
said the boy, but Feld knew he was lying. Having a senator for a father had schooled the boy in many of the political arts, and he was almost as skilled a dissembler of the truth as a seasoned veteran of the Palatine Forum. Almost, but not quite.
There's no way you could have known how to avoid the laser net without help.
All right, admitted Arcturus. I had help. I persuaded Lon Helion to give me the specs for the lasers so I could modify that geosurvey unit to make them visible. I told him it was for a school project.
Then Lon Helion will be looking for a new job in the morning.
Yes, I suppose he will.
Anger touched Feld at Arcturus's lack of concern for the man whose life he had just ruined for the sake of a prank, and at the boy's need to challenge the limits of his abilities.
Come on, said Arcturus. Tell me, how did you find me? Some new system I didn't know about? A biometric reader? A DNA scanner?
Feld looked at the young, eager face and felt his anger melt away. Angus Menx's son had a quality that caused those around him to forget their ire and want to please him. Only his father and mother seemed immune to his charms.
It wasn't a new system, it was an old system you forgot about.
An old system, what?
EB Mark I,
said Feld, picking up the geosurvey unit.
EB Mark I? Repeated Arcturus. I've never heard of that one. Is that Lars Corp? No, wait, it has to be Gemini, yes?
Neither, said Feld, pointing to his eye. Eyeball, Mark I. I saw you on the spy cams as you came in through the kitchen.
Spy cams? What spy cams?
The new Terra model spy cams your father had installed last week, in time for that Umojin ambassador's visit.
Who?
Do you listen to anything that goes on in this house that doesn't involve you?
Not if it's anything to do with my father. It's all politics and business. Far too boring to pay attention to, said Arcturus. So who's here?
A man named Aelin Pastor and his daughter, said Feld. Apparently he's some sort of bigwig on Umoja, and he wants to talk trade with your father.
That wasn't entirely true, but Arcturus had displayed little enough interest in the senator's dealings before now for Feld to bother with explaining further. World-changing events were in motion, and all Arcturus wanted to do was piss his father off and spend his time with his coterie of sycophants at the academy or his collection of rocks and gems. With the geosurvey unit confiscated, Actonfeld turned and made his way to the door.
Oh, and You'd best tell your friends the game's up.
My friends? Said Arcturus. What do you mean?
Don't, warned Feld. Just tell them to go home. It's late and I'm too tired to deal with any more nonsense.
Honestly, Feld, I have no idea what you are talking about. Acton Feld stared hard at the boy, looking past his glib exterior and power to make the unbelievable believable. Arcturus Menx could, with a few words, get Tex within 10 years' experience to give up the specs for a laser net, but Feld knew that what he was hearing now was the unvarnished truth. Which meant...
Crap, said Feld, activating the comm unit on his wrist. All units condition black. I repeat, condition black.
Feld turned back to Arcturus.
Stay here, he said, and hide.
What is it? Cried Arcturus as Feld ran for the door. Feld drew his pistol and said,
Intruders.
Arcturus watched Feld disappear through the door, and it took a moment for the implication of the head of security's words to penetrate.
Intruders. Here?
Arcturus now wished he had not thought to try and test himself against the defenses of his father's home. It seemed suddenly foolish and childishly impulsive. Close on the heels of that thought was the idea that his family might actually be in danger, and he felt a knot of warm fear settle in his belly. The emotion was quickly suppressed, and contrary to Feld's instructions, Arcturus bolted from his room into the corridor. Lights were coming on throughout the house, and shouted voices were rousing guards from their posts. As doors slammed, Arcturus was suddenly rooted to the spot with indecision. The hard bang of a pistol shot echoed in the hallway, and a man's scream galvanized him into motion. He set off farther down the corridor and skidded to a halt beside a door hung with paper flowers and a child's drawing of a pony tacked to it. Colorful paper letters declared that this was Dorothy's room. And Arcturus pushed it open. The lights were on, and he pulled up short as he saw his 4-year-old sister sitting in bed, her long dark curls spilling messily around her shoulders as she sleepily rubbed her eyes. Sitting next to her in the bed was a young girl, roughly Arcturus's age, whose blonde hair shone like honey and whose face was as beautiful as it was unexpected.
"Who are you?"
demanded the girl, putting protective arms around Dorothy.
"I could ask you the same damn thing," said Arcturus. "What are you doing in my sister's room?" "I'm Juliana Pasteur," said the girl. "Dorothy asked me to stay and read her a story. I guess we must have both fallen asleep. You must be Arcturus, but what's going on? Was that a gunshot?"
"Yes, and I'm not sure exactly what's going on," said Arcturus, rushing over to the bed. "I think we might be under attack."
"Attack? From whom?"
Arcturus ignored the question and knelt beside the bed.
"Little Dot," he said, keeping his voice even and using his sister's pet name. "You have to get up."
At the sound of Arcturus's voice, Dorothy looked at him, and his anger rose as he saw the tears in her eyes. Arcturus did not care much for his father or his dealings, but he doted on his sister. Her smile was able to melt the hardest of hearts, and not even Angus could resist giving in to her every whim.
"Where are we going?"
said Dorothy, her voice drowsy. Before Arcturus could answer, more gunshots boomed. Dorothy squealed in terror. Arcturus looked up at Juliana Pasteur and said,
"Look after her. I'll see what's happening."
Juliana nodded and clutched the little girl tightly as the door to the room opened and 2 people burst in. Arcturus leapt to his feet but let out a relieved breath as he saw that one of the figures was his mother. Catherine Mengsk was tall, beautiful, and slender, but she was no shrinking violet who spent all her time at needlepoint or recitals. A core of neo-steel ran through her, and with her children threatened, that quality was in the ascendancy. She blinked in surprise to see Arcturus, but overcame that surprise in a heartbeat and quickly gathered her children as the man next to her ran over to Juliana.
"Are you all right?" asked Catherine. "Arcturus, Dorothy." "We're fine, Mother," said Arcturus, prizing himself free of her embrace. "Where's Father?" Catherine lifted Dorothy to her breast.
"He's with Acton. Some men are trying to get inside, and they've gone to stop them."
More shots sounded from beyond the door, and Dorothy burst into tears. His mother turned to the man who had entered the room with her and nodded to Juliana.
"Is she okay?"
"She's fine," said the man, his voice strong and lyrical.
Arcturus thought the man looked around the same age as his father, which put him in his mid-40s. His concern over Juliana identified him as Alain Pasteur, and Arcturus thought him an unimpressive man for an ambassador from so important a world as Umoja. Receding gray hair and a weak chin conspired to make Alain Pasteur look timid, but from an early age, Arcturus's father had warned him that where politicians and men of words were concerned, it was almost always the ones you underestimated who would bring you down.
"What's going on, Mother?" asked Arcturus. "Are we really under attack?"
"Yes," said Catherine, nodding.
His mother was never one to sugar the pill. It was one of the things Arcturus loved about her. Alain Pasteur took his daughter by the hand as Catherine Mengsk said,
"Now we need to get to the refuge. Everyone follow me and no dawdling."
The bark of automatic weapon fire roared from somewhere nearby. The noise was so loud it was impossible to pinpoint the source of it, but Arcturus thought it was coming from this floor. He heard booted footsteps and more shouts. Arcturus hauled on his mother's hand as more shooting exploded nearby. The wooden frame around the bedroom door splintered as gunfire tore through it. Everyone screamed and dropped to the floor. Arcturus covered his ears as a clatter of metal and wood rained down from the shattered door. A twisted spike of silver rolled across the carpet, a thin cone of metal as thick as the tip of his pinky. Arcturus recognized it immediately, ammunition fired from a military-grade assault rifle. A C-14 gauze rifle, to be precise. An impaler. He heard thumps from outside, and two men spun around the doorway. One was Acton Feld, his slug thrower smoking and blood pouring from wounds in his arm and chest. The other was armed with the impaler rifle, and Arcturus recognized him as one of his father's security guards, a man named Jacques Delors. As Feld's gaze swept the room, he spoke hurriedly into his shoulder mic.
"Angus, it's Feld. I've got them. We're in Dot's room."
Arcturus missed the reply as another roar of gunfire sounded. Delore quickly leaned around the door and fired off a couple of shots. The noise of the gun was deafening, especially mixed together with Dorothy's sobbing cries.
"Acton," said Catherine, "where is my husband?"
"Downstairs organizing the defense, but he's on his way," said Feld, slamming a fresh magazine into the butt of his pistol and awkwardly racking the slide. "Then we have to get out of here. We're too exposed. The refuge is just along the hall."
"We can't go out there," said Alain Pasteur.
"We'll be killed."
"We'll be killed if we stay here, Alain," replied Catherine.
"No time to argue," said Feld, his face pale with blood loss. "They have men coming in from both sides. Jacques, how's it looking?"
Jacques Delors raised his rifle and leaned around the door, checking left and right. He fired a burst of impaler rounds along the length of the corridor, and Arcturus heard a scream of pain.
"Clear now,"
said Delors as the sound of gunfire intensified. Arcturus could make no sense of this. All he could hear was a meaningless cacophony of cries for cover, medical attention, or mothers. Who was winning this fight? Did anyone know?
"Now," shouted Feld. "Let's go."
Feld was first out of the room, his pistol extended, as Delore hustled Catherine, still with Dorothy clutched to her chest, Alain Pasteur and Juliana through the door. Lastly came Arcturus, and Delore remained with him as they sped along the corridor toward the refuge. Smoke from the gunfire filled the hallway, and Arcturus could see little beyond the floor in the dim glow of sputtering lights that had been shot out. He passed a bulky shape lying on the ground, a body with a bullet wound in the neck. Blood squirted onto the floor from the ragged crater in the man's throat, and Arcturus gagged at the horrid, burned metallic smell of the man's death. Another man's body lay farther along the corridor, this one with his chest torn apart by impaler spikes. It looked like he'd been sawn in two. Delore kept watch on their rear as Feld haltingly led the way to the refuge. A fortified bolt hole constructed in the heart of the house with comm systems capable of reaching Korhal's orbitals and enough supplies to last 4 days. Arcturus's mother had objected to the idea of installing such an ugly thing in her summer house, but had reluctantly consented to its construction after a crazed psychopath had murdered Senator Nikos and his family in their beds a few years ago. A crazed psychopath who is probably now a neurally re-socialized Confederate Marine. Arcturus stumbled, but Delore held him upright. The refuge was up ahead, its neo-steel door open and a cold, fluorescent light spilling from inside. The wounded Acton Feld lay slumped in the doorway, his face ashen as he tried to hold his slug-thrower level. Shouts sounded behind Arcturus, urgent and demanding. Jacques Delore released him and spun around, dropping to one knee and bringing his rifle up. The barrel exploded with noise and light, and Arcturus cried out at the unimaginable volume of the weapon. Gauze spikes roared from the barrel, and more screams of pain followed. "Go!" shouted Delore. No sooner had he given his last instruction than Jacques Delore was struck by a burst of impaler fire. It was as if a giant fist had hammered into his side and hurled him against the wall. Blood spattered Arcturus, and he watched in horror as Delore's head lolled down over his chest, almost severed by the impact of the impaler spikes. "Arcturus!" screamed his mother from the refuge, but her voice seemed tinny and indistinct. All he could hear was the last rasp of Delore's breath and the sound of his blood as it sprayed from his ruined neck. Without conscious thought, Arcturus knelt down and lifted Delore's fallen rifle. He'd never fired such a weapon before, but figured all you needed to do was point it at what you wanted to kill and pull the trigger. How hard could it be? A shape resolved itself from the smoke of the corridor, a gunman dressed in dark fatigues, body armor, and a strange helmet. It had a number of projecting attachments jutting from the side, and a matte black visor upon which Arcturus could see his own face reflected. The rifle was a dead weight in his hands, but he raised it without conscious thought. The gunman already had his rifle aimed, and Arcturus knew he would not be able to pull the trigger before he was torn apart. The thought made him more angry than fearful. Before the gunman could fire, Arcturus's reflection in the helmet's visor exploded in a mist of plexiglass fragments, bone, and brain matter. Another shot struck the gunman's helmet, then another, and another. The man dropped to his knees as high-velocity slugs tore into his chest and legs. Arcturus turned and saw his mother marching toward him, Acton Feld's slug-thrower held out before her in both hands. With her long black hair unbound and her nightdress flaring behind her like a cloak, she looked like some warrior woman from the old myth stories. The gun boomed in her grip, and she never once broke step as she fired. Arcturus watched the gunman die and dropped the gauze rifle as his mother's hand clamped on his shoulder. He looked up and saw that her face was thunderous with anger, not at Arcturus, but at the man who had dared threaten one of her children. Catherine pulled Arcturus to his feet and all but dragged him into the refuge. With help from Aelin Pasteur, she hauled the heavy door of the refuge shut. then punched in the locking code to a keypad set into the wall. Arcturus took heaving gulps of clean, recycled air, feeling his hands shaking at how close he'd come to death. He clenched his fists, angry at such a display of weakness, and fought down his fear through sheer force of will. In control of himself once more, he took stock of his surroundings. Actonfeld lay slumped against one wall, his chest and shoulder a mass of sticky red fluid, but Arcturus couldn't tell whether he was alive or dead. Juliana Pasteur sat against the opposite wall of the refuge, holding Dorothy tight, and Arcturus went to them. He stroked his sister's hair and smiled reassuringly at Juliana.
"Little Dot," said Arcturus, "it's me. We're safe now."
Dorothy looked up and Arcturus smiled, putting every ounce of sincerity into his words.
"You are very brave, little one. No one is going to hurt us now."
"We're safe,"
said Dorothy between snotty exhalations.
"You promise?"
"I promise," said Arcturus, nodding. "I won't let anything happen to you. Ever."
"Never ever?"
"Never ever," promised Arcturus.
With the door to the refuge sealed, there was nothing to do but wait. And waiting was something Arcturus Mengsk wasn't particularly good at. He sat on a fold-down cot bed with his legs crossed and Dorothy's head resting on his thigh, her thumb jammed in her mouth, and a stuffed pony named Pontius clutched tightly beneath one arm. Despite all that had happened, she had fallen into a deep sleep, and Arcturus smiled as he ran a hand through her dark hair. As it turned out, Actonfeld was still alive, and Arcturus's mother was doing her best to treat the impaler wounds in his shoulder. With the practical mindset that had made her such a formidable matriarch of the Mengsk family, Catherine set about assigning them all tasks, as much to keep their minds busy as to actually achieve anything useful. Arcturus was told to look after Juliana and Dorothy, while Aelin Pasteur was ordered to keep watch on the vidcams to get a better idea of what was happening beyond the refuge. The Umojan ambassador nodded, taking a seat by the wall of monitors that displayed a multitude of images of both the exterior and interior of the Mengsk summer villa. Arcturus wasn't surprised that his mother had taken charge, or that Pasteur had so readily acquiesced to her, for Catherine Mengsk had an aura that conveyed absolute authority, confidence, and credibility. Even at 17, Arcturus was old enough to appreciate his mother's strength of character and knew that his father had learned, over the years, not to underestimate her. Without looking up from Actonfeld's wound, Catherine said,
"Aelin, what's going on out there? Can you see Angus?"
Arcturus watched as Pasteur scanned the images before him. Empty corridors, dead bodies, and black-clad figures dashing furtively from cover to cover. But the ambassador couldn't tell whether the figures were the attackers or Angus's security forces. Some of the cameras had been disabled, the screens displaying a hash of static so that it was impossible to tell exactly what was happening.
"There's still men with guns on the ground floor, but I can't see Angus, no." "Well, keep looking," said Catherine.
Pasteur nodded and returned his attention to the screens as Catherine stood and wiped her bloody hands on the front of her nightdress. His mother's face was strained yet beautiful, and Arcturus smiled as he remembered the sight of her standing over him with Feld's pistol blazing as she killed the man who was about to shoot him.
"Your mother seems very calm," said Juliana Pasteur beside him. "Does she know something we don't?"
Arcturus turned his head to face Juliana. With time to think, he made a fuller inspection of her. He'd thought she was beautiful when he'd first seen her, but now, looking more closely, he saw that he had done her a disservice. Juliana Pasteur was more than beautiful. She was absolutely stunning. and made all the more so because she plainly had no idea of how attractive she was. The girls at the academy were either driven politicos who bored him, or academic types who were no challenge to seduce. He sensed Juliana would fit into neither of these camps. The nightdress clung to the curves of her body, and his 17-year-old mind pictured what she looked like underneath it. He shook off that image, knowing that this was neither the time nor the place for such thoughts. "My mother is a strong woman," he said at last. "My mother got sick and died when I was very young," said Juliana. "I barely remember her."
Arcturus heard the weary sorrow in her voice, but did not know what to say.
He did not deal well with grief, for he could never empathize with those who had suffered loss, and found them unpleasant to be around.
"I'm sorry," he said at last.
Juliana nodded, seemingly oblivious to his discomfort.
"Are we safe in here?"
she asked. Arcturus nodded. Pleased, the conversation had shifted to a subject he could speak on with some authority.
"Yes, we're perfectly safe," he said. "The walls of this refuge are 3 feet of plascrete with neo-steel reinforcement bars. It would take the mining guild's biggest drills, at least a BDE 1400, to get through. Maybe even the 1600.
You know a lot about drills."
"A little,"
he said, with just the right hint of modesty for her to infer that he knew a lot about drills.
"I plan on becoming a prospector someday." "Aren't you going to go into one of your father's businesses?"
Arcturus's face darkened at the mention of his father.
"No, not if I can help it.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's his speaking out against the Confederacy and meddling in things that don't concern him that's gotten us into this mess."
"What the Confederacy is doing should concern everybody," said Juliana.
"Maybe," said Arcturus with a shrug, looking over to Aelin Pastor to find some clue as to the state of affairs beyond the refuge.
"I don't really know, and I don't really care. I just want to be left alone to make my own way in the galaxy." "But if the Confederacy goes on the way it is, no one will be able to do that."
Arcturus glanced over at Aelin Pastor.
"Did your father tell you that?" "As a matter of fact, it was your father," said Juliana archly.
"Then I have even less interest in it."
"You are very polite, are you?"
"I don't know you," pointed out Arcturus. "Why do I need to be polite to you?"
"Because even fringe worlders know it is good manners to be polite to a guest."
He saw the color in her cheeks and realized she was right. He was being rude, and being rude to such a pretty girl seemed like the behavior of a savage, not that of a senator's son. Arcturus took a deep breath and flashed his most dazzling smile, the one that melted the hearts of the girls at the academy who briefly piqued his interest.
"You're right, I am being rude, and I'm sorry. This has been an unusual evening. I'm not normally like this. Normally I am actually quite pleasant to be around."
She stared at him, trying to crack the mask of his handsome sincerity, but even the most desirable of sterling socialites had tried and failed to do that. Juliana Pastor would have no chance beneath the glare of his charm.
"Apology accepted," she said with a smile,
but Arcturus knew she wasn't yet hooked.
"You're a sharp one, aren't you? I like that,"
he said, more interested in Aelin Pastor's daughter now that she had displayed a measure of resistance to his wiles.
"Korhal may be one of the jewels in the Confederate crown, but Umoja isn't without culture and breeding."
"I've never traveled there," said Arcturus.
"Maybe I will soon, if all its maidens are like you." "They're not, but I think you would like it there."
"I'm sure I would."
"Would you be my guide?"
"Perhaps," said Juliana.
"I could show you Sarango Canyon."
"Where the supercarrier crashed?" said Arcturus.
"It's said to be breathtaking."
You have no idea, promised Juliana.
Well, if we live through the night, I'll be sure to take you up on that, said Arcturus, his light tone robbing the comment of any danger.
Juliana smiled, but before Arcturus could say any more, Aelin Pasteur said,
Catherine, the door.
Arcturus looked over to the bank of monitors, but the vid camera showing the corridor had been shot out in the fighting. A series of clicking beeps came from the keypad next to the door, and Catherine bent to examine the sequence before typing in her own code. This was in turn answered by another series of key punches from the other side, which was again answered by Catherine. His mother nodded to Aelin Pasteur and then typed in a last key sequence that disengaged the locks. Arcturus felt a mixture of relief and disappointment that their time here was to be cut short, but smiled as he felt Juliana's hand take his and squeeze it in nervous anticipation. The thick neo-steel door of the refuge swung open, and Angus Mengsk, Senator of Korhal, father to Arcturus and Dorothy, and husband to Catherine, entered with an impaler rifle cradled in his arms. Angus was a broad, powerfully built man, his dark hair pulled into a long ponytail that, like his beard, was lined with silver streaks. His features were strong, gnarled with age, and a pair of cold, gray eyes stared out from beneath a bushy set of eyebrows. He swung the rifle over his shoulder and took his wife into a crushing bear hug.
"Thank God you're safe," he said. "I knew you'd look after them."
"We're all fine," said Catherine. "Acton's been hit, but he'll live. Is it over?"
Angus released his wife from his embrace and nodded.
"They're all dead, yes."
Arcturus swallowed nervously as he saw his father finally notice him sitting on the bed. Angus prized his gaze from Arcturus and shook hands with Aelin Pasteur, his scowl replaced with the practiced smile of a politician.
"Good to see you're still alive, my friend."
"And you, Angus," said Pasteur. "A bad business, this, and no mistake. Confederates?"
"Maybe," said Angus. "We'll talk later, eh?"
Pasteur nodded, and Angus moved past him to stand before Arcturus, the politician's smile falling from his face like a discarded mask.
"What in the name of the fathers are you doing here, boy?" demanded Angus. "Have you been thrown out of the academy again?"
"Nice to see you too, father," said Arcturus.
Chapter 2 Angus Mengsk poured himself a generous measure of brandy from an expensive crystal decanter and downed the amber liquid in one swallow. He closed his eyes and allowed the molten taste to line his throat and settle in his stomach before pouring another glass. He lifted up the bottle inquiringly toward Aelin Pasteur, but the Umojan ambassador shook his head.
"No, thank you, Angus."
"I know you don't drink, Aelin," said Angus, "but under the circumstances..."
"Angus, I can't."
"Come on, man," cajoled Angus. "Surely one won't hurt."
"He said he didn't want one," said Catherine, replacing the stopper in the decanter and glaring sternly at her husband.
"There's no such thing as just one for me."
"Not anymore," said Pasteur.
"Fine,"
said Angus, shrugging and taking his own drink back to the table. In the aftermath of the attack, Angus had gathered the occupants of the summer villa in the main dining room, a long, oak-paneled room dominated by an exquisite rosewood table carved with pastoral scenes of a rustic Korhal that had probably never existed. An exquisite chess set with pieces carved from jet and ivory sat next to the drinks cabinet, the pieces apparently arranged in mid-game, though the white king was in checkmate. Angus's wife took a seat at the end of the table, next to Dorothy and Aelin Pasteur's daughter, and he allowed himself a moment of quiet relief that his girls had been spared the worst of this night's bloodshed. His mood darkened as he shot a glance over to Arcturus, the boy sitting with his arms folded across his chest and his eyes steadfastly refusing to meet those of his father. Acton Feld had managed to haul himself from his sickbed to join them. The man looked terrible, his skin gray and greasy with sweat. Everyone knew he should have been resting, but, to his credit, he had found the strength to be part of their debate as to what was to be done about this terrible night and how best to repay those responsible. Angus paced the length of the table, his expression murderous, his eyes smoldering with anger.
"Angus," said Catherine, "sit down before you wear a hole in the carpet, and calm down."
"Calm down!" exploded Angus. "They tried to kill us in our own house. Armed men came into our house and tried to kill us all. I swear I'll lead the army to the Palatine Forum and strangle Lennox Craven with my bare hands if he had something to do with this. For God's sake, Cat, how can I be calm at a time like this?"
"Because you need to be," said Catherine firmly. "You are a senator of Korhal, and you don't have the luxury of anger. It achieves nothing, and only clouds your judgment. Besides, you don't know yet who was behind this. It might not be Craven and his Confederate goons."
Lennox Craven was the senior consul of the Korhal Senate, the man tasked with ensuring that the will of the Confederacy was carried out, upholding its laws and providing a controlling influence on the unruly senators below him. Angus loathed the man, believing him to be little more than a stooge for the corrupt old families that governed the Confederacy from the shadows. But for all that, Craven was a formidable senator and canny businessman, and Angus had exchanged many an incendiary barb with him across the marble floor of the Palatine Forum. The Manx family was one of the old families, too, one of the oldest, in fact, and Craven never tired of reminding Angus that he was spitting in the eye of the establishment that had given him such power and wealth. Angus took a deep breath and nodded, smiling at Catherine as he took a drink.
"You're right, my dear," he said. "I need to think this through clearly. Acton, do you have any thoughts on what happened here tonight? Who were these men?"
"Professionals," said Acton Feld. "They were good, but we got the drop on them, thanks to Arcturus's stunt. A few minutes more and, well, I don't like to think what might have happened."
"And you and I are going to talk about the security here later,"
promised Angus, staring at his son.
"But who were they?"
Acton Feld chewed his bottom lip for a moment, then said,
"Everything about them leads me to think they're a corporate death squad, a black ops unit used to kill off business rivals and engage in corporate espionage, kidnapping, and that kind of thing."
"Why would anyone want to target Angus?" asked Catherine. "And why now?"
"Perhaps someone got wind of the things Angus is going to address in his close of session speech to the Senate," suggested Pasteur.
"It's sure to ruffle some feathers, to say the least," agreed Angus.
"But that's not for months," protested Catherine. "And your business interests only benefit Korhal. A lot of people on Korhal have become very wealthy thanks to their dealings with the Confederacy," said Pasteur. "Plenty of organizations have ties to both Korhal and the Confederacy, and Angus is stirring up trouble for them. If the Confederacy were to be kicked off Korhal, they would stand to lose millions."
"I know it's a long shot, Acton, but is there anything on the bodies that might tell us who sent them?"
asked Angus.
Feld shook his head. "The kit they used is all ex-military stuff, the kind you can pick up easily enough if you know where to look. It looks like something local, but I don't buy it. My gut's telling me something different."
"And what is your gut telling you?" asked Catherine.
"That this is bigger than some corporation trying to hold on to its savings."
"Why do you think that?" said Angus.
"Because all those dead men are Marines. Or at least, they were."
"Marines? How do you know?"
Feld reached up and tapped the back of his neck.
"They've all been brain-panned. All six of them have got neural resocialization scars."
Alan Pasteur cleared his throat.
"Well, naturally, that leads us to the Confederacy."
"You're probably right, Alan," said Angus. "But it seems heavy-handed even for them."
"Really? You heard about the rebellion on Antigua Prime?"
"No. What rebellion? I didn't see anything about that on the UNN.
"Well, you wouldn't, would you?" pointed out Catherine. "Are you always saying that the old families control the corporations that run the news channels? They broadcast what they want you to see. Their version of the truth in 20-second sound bites."
"That's true enough," replied Angus. "But what of Antigua Prime?"
"Yes, well, apparently the people of Andasaw City kicked out the Confederate militia and held the local magistrate hostage. They demanded an end to Confederate corruption, and whole districts rallied to their call to arms. The city was as good as an open revolt, but 2 days later, a troop of Marines under a Lieutenant Nightingale went in and took the place back. And they didn't leave any survivors."
"Good God," said Angus. "How many dead?"
"No one knows for sure, but my sources say the figure is in the thousands."
"And that's exactly why we need to be careful here," pointed out Catherine. "If the Confederacy isn't shy about perpetrating a massacre like that, then clearly they don't have any compunction against killing a senator and his family, do they?" "But why send re-socialized Marines?" asked Arcturus, lifting his head up from staring at the table. "Surely any dead bodies would be easy to trace back to the Confederacy."
"Because they didn't expect to fail," said Angus, returning to the crystal decanter on the drinks cabinet and pouring himself another glass of brandy. "Well, paymasters expected them to kill us all and not leave any of their own dead behind. The damned arrogance of it!"
"Then why bother making them look like corporate killers?" said Arcturus.
"Plausible deniability," said Actonfeld. "In case the assassins were caught on any kind of surveillance. Corporate-sponsored murders are terrible, if not exactly uncommon. But if it was discovered that the Confederacy was complicit in the murder of a prominent senator..."
"The planet would erupt in revolt," finished Catherine.
Angus laughed without humor.
"Almost makes me wish they got me after all."
"Don't say that," snapped Catherine. "Not ever."
"Sorry, dear," said Angus, standing behind his wife and kissing her cheek. "I didn't mean that, but I feel it's going to take something truly dreadful to bring the Confederacy to its knees. We won't beat them overnight, but we will beat them, and I'll tell you how."
Once again, Angus paced the length of the table as he spoke, allowing his voice to become the rich baritone he used when speaking in the forum.
"It's their arrogance that will be their undoing. They can't see how they can possibly do anything wrong, and when you can't see that, you make mistakes. My father once said that when all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail."
Angus paused and turned to address his audience.
"We'll show them what happens when the nail hits back."
The dining room was empty, save for Angus and Arcturus, the two sharing an